Good morning. Welcome back to the roundtable and to our panel discussion for this Wednesday, the 5th of June. A quick thank you to everyone who helped in the lockbox, all of the folks here at WAMC who worked to take pledges, and of course, all of the folks who called in or went online and did something this morning. We are well over $265,000 in the lockbox, which is just fantastic, and we thank you so much from the bottom of our hearts for making that happen. It was a really great morning, and we appreciate it. This is where I unfortunately have to say, well, we still have a long way to go. So if you miss that train, don't worry, there's another one coming, and you can certainly help out right now by going to wamc.org. Let's go to the panel and begin this morning and talk about issues of the day. We have a great list of panelists, and we have some, I think, interesting topics to discuss as well. Let us go in alphabetical order. We welcome former New York 19 Congressman John Faso. Good morning, sir. How
good morning,
are you?
Joe. Great to be here, and hopefully the lockbox gets filled even more.
Yeah, well, thank you. Ray and I were doing the lockbox, and we were just, you know, you get tapped a little bit. And then John brought in donuts, and I was like, oh, thank God. That was very nice of you. Thank you.
Well, Golden Harvest in Valencia, we say those are the best donuts in the Capital Region.
I agree. It was, right now, it's the best donut I've ever had in my life. It was just fantastic. Thank you very much. We also welcome Dean of the College of Emergency Preparedness, Homeland Security, and Cybersecurity at the University at Albany, Bob Griffin, who is in an undisclosed location, I believe. Is that
Joe, how are you? Thanks, and talk about phoning it in. I'm certainly phoning it in today.
Well, it's good to have you here. I'll take Bob Griffin on the phone over not having Bob Griffin at all. This is very nice to have you with us. Thank you. I know you're taking some time out of personal time to do this, and I really appreciate it. It means a lot to us. Welcome to the program. We also welcome Sarah Rogerson, Albany Law School professor and director of the Immigration Law Clinic. Hello, Sarah.
How are you? Hi. I'm okay.
Excellent. We welcome you all, too. All you have to do is write to us, panel at WAMC.org. We'll be going to 11 o'clock this morning, panel at WAMC.org, and we would love to hear from you. Let us begin with this story. Guess what, Sarah? You're going to start us off on this.
I guess I might.
Here's this is from the New York Times, to restrict migrants. Biden leans on Trump's favorite immigration law. That's the way it is termed in the New York Times. Looking for a way to shut down the southern border in 2018, President Trump found a 73-word provision in the asylum law that he said gave him, quote, magical authorities to keep migrants out of the country. President Biden turned to that same provision on Tuesday as he took executive action to temporarily close the border to asylum seekers, suspending long-standing guarantees that anyone who steps onto U.S. soil has the right to ask for protection in America. The simple truth is there is a worldwide migrant crisis, Mr. Biden said in remarks at the White House. And if the United States doesn't secure our border, there's no limit to the number of people who may try to come here. Mr. Biden's announcement is a stunning reversal for a president and a party that spent years arguing that America was a country of immigrants. When President Barack Obama wanted to shore up his chances of re-election in 2012, he issued a sweeping executive order on immigration, one that allowed millions of immigrants to stay in the country legally. All right, Sarah, what should we make of this executive order from President Biden?
So what's standing out for me this time around, because this happens every election cycle, immigrants bear the burden of our broken political system every single time because they can't vote. So, you know, it makes headlines. It's the top story everywhere. It's doing what it's intended to do. And it's making Biden look tough, which he desperately needs right now. And it doesn't reflect Democratic values whatsoever. It doesn't even reflect a lot of Republican values, to be honest, which are rooted in faith-based pro-immigration ideals in some cases. And brass tacks, you know, I've read a lot of people's responses to this, and there's a lot of really good points being raised about the inhumaneness of what Biden's decision is leading to. But that doesn't seem to be persuasive to voters or anybody else. And maybe I'm becoming cynical, but I'd rather raise the point that it's also an economic shot in the foot. It's really stupid to tighten the border when we have a labor shortage. What would be a better idea is to give people work authorization the moment they arrive, not make them wait 6 months, file hundreds of pages of proof that they've suffered, force people into homeless shelters, and tell them to just hang out for a while. That's a bad policy. That's what we've been doing for the last year, and it doesn't work. Give them work authorization, let them work in the formal, not the informal labor market. Our economy flourishes, our labor shortage is minimized, and families can stay together. The other weird piece is that the White House seems to be saying, well, we're not separating families. We're not tearing children out of parents' arms. We're not discriminating on the basis of religion. This isn't a Muslim ban. So we really are at the point where the Democrats on immigration are at the bottom of the barrel and finding new ways to make it deeper.
So just help me out here before we hear from the other panelists, and that is, Trump found this provision when, well, someone in the Trump administration found
Stephen Miller
found the provision and then made it was an executive order.
Yes, because the executive has a lot of power in the Immigration and Nationality Act to do all kinds of stuff. And the attorney general really has even more authority than the president explicitly.
And then upon entering office, Biden reversed it.
Ish. Right.
And so this is a return to what it was, to its 2018 strength?
Ish. Not really. There were also other things that the Trump administration did. I mean, I think Stephen Miller has a lot of unresolved childhood trauma that has manifested in this obsession with discrimination against all types of immigrants, but particularly Black and brown people. So there was a... There were metering provisions, which would take a long time to explain. There were all kinds of other things. There was also, remember, the Trump administration closed the border presumably to curb the spread of the pandemic, which was also ridiculous. So it's different, but the effects are going to be similar in that it's going to create a security risk. I'm looking forward to hearing from Bob on that. And, you know, like, when you have a worldwide migration, quote unquote, crisis, the solution isn't to seal off help. It's to figure out where people are moving, why, and either address the root causes, or in the case of climate change, if we can't do that fast enough, care for the people. They're people.
Right. Bob, what say you?
You know, Joe, I have sort of mixed feelings on this whole situation. I mean, part of me views this as sort of a cynical policy shift that comes before elections. It does, I think, fundamentally change where the Biden administration has been on immigration. You raised some really interesting points that I would like to touch on and then hear from you and John and stuff. One, I don't think the country can afford a zero immigration policy. I mean, I think part of the concern I have is that when I look at our birth rates, when I look at what's going on with our employment rates, I keep asking sort of the question of, well, who's going to do some of the work that honestly we depend on the immigrant community to do. So the idea of actually talking about this, not just as a policy question about immigration, but also about economics, I think is really important. And it's not something that I think is being done by either party. We also, you know, so you touched on a really critical point about what's different today than was different prior to COVID. And certainly COVID changed the border position, but the whole world is going through a series of upheavals. If you think about war, if you start to think about famine, start to think about what's happening in because of climate change, because of crackdowns in regimes in places like Africa and South America, the world really is in turmoil. And the idea of saying that we're just going to, close the door is, it sounds good on paper. In reality, it's almost impossible to do. And as I think about the enforcement of this, and I think this ties in with your comment about the security crisis, is what happens, the people who are desperately trying to get into this country because it offers safety and offers a better opportunity, they're going to continue to try to come across the border, which means that now we have an even larger logistical problem of how to enforce this executive order. What do you do with all of these people, and how do you do it in a way that preserves at least some modicum of our own humanity, even if at times with these policies we want to ignore the humanity of the immigrant community. I guess the cynical side of me, Joe, says, if Biden was up by 15, 20 points on the polls, would he have done this? And I'm not sure he would. I think this really is more a reflection of looking at a softness in his numbers and an area of concern in his political leanings that he's trying to address.
John Fesso.
Well, picking up on what Bob just said and also some of what Sarah said, this is entirely political. If you look at surveys of voters, and I've been looking at these things pretty closely for the last number of months, when voters are asked what are the most important issues, it's economy and it's immigration overwhelmingly. And in many other places, it's also a subset crime. Those are the most important issues. And you'll see when voters are asked these questions, it's economy, inflation, cost of living. That's 25 to 30%. When the second most important issue is immigration. And voters across the board, and this includes large majorities of Republicans, large majorities of independent voters, and about 40% or so of Democratic voters will say that this immigration is the most important issue in their mind. The Biden announcement yesterday is entirely political because he is getting swamped when the voters are asked which candidate, Biden or Trump, do you favor on specific policies. Biden is losing on all the main issues that people identify as the most important ones. On immigration, Trump is ahead of Biden by about 30 points nationally. And I suspect, because it's very difficult to change public opinion on the dime, it's kind of like an ocean liner trying to turn it around to turn direction. The Biden administration announcement yesterday, even though it's not all it's making it out to be, it's not everything that they are trying to create the impression that he's getting tough on immigration, et cetera. And to some degree he is, but in large respect, it isn't. It's strictly a political exercise. And I don't think it's going to have the intended political benefit or effect. And as Sarah noted, it could actually wind up dividing some of the Democratic base on this issue. We've seen them extraordinarily divided on the Israel-Gaza war. And that is something that is hurting Biden tremendously. In fact, when people semi-jocularly say Biden supports the two-state solution on the Israel-Gaza war, they're talking about Minnesota and Michigan as the two states. They're worried about Senate races actually in Nevada and Michigan more than anything else. I don't see this is going to divide part of the Democratic base, which is a problem for the president, but I don't see it reversing the direction or the opinion of the country on which candidate is going to be better on dealing with this issue. I think that is kind of baked already, and I don't see this order yesterday changing it very much.
Which is horrifying, because, you know, in some ways it's strictly political, but the effects are not. The effects are dramatic for directly impacted people at the border. And even though it's not an absolute zero migration plan, right, it's 2,500 people a day, there's the same problems about how are we going to administer that. The last time we tried to do this under Trump, there were lines of people. There were informal refugee camps that sprung up along the border of Mexico and the United States. There was an increase in crime, not among immigrants, but among human traffickers and criminals and criminal enterprises that preyed on their vulnerability that was state created. It's interesting to note that Mexico just elected its first female president.
Right.
A climate scientist, of all things, who probably knows a lot, actually, about the push-pull factors of migration, including climate change. She has a good relationship. She's been in government for a long time. She's worked with the former president, sort of has, it's been reported that she was hand-selected, right? So it'll be interesting to see how she manages the impact that's inevitable. And, you know, a lot of the times when Trump would do these things, it was political, too. I don't know how else to communicate to the American public the negative impacts of these policies and the bevy of alternatives that are available. I mean, in 2018, I know John worked on a bill that I disagreed with. But it was an attempt, bipartisan attempt, right? The problem with that bill is that it would have removed lawful paths to citizenship, and we don't have enough. And that's the problem. We make it too hard. We create insurmountable barriers for people to live their life, to live the American dream to the extent that that still exists. And so, you know, it's, we do it domestically as well. It's not just on immigration. You know, we erect insurmountable barriers to people climbing out of poverty as well.
One of the things that I think should be done, and I don't know that this could be done through executive order, but we have what are called H-2A and H-2B visas, where you can bring in folks who want to work, and you particularly see this in the agricultural sector. And it's critically important in resort and tourism, critically important. And these are all legitimate jobs. And we only let a few hundred thousand people a year come in to the country for these purposes. We should greatly expand that. The thing that is, I think, most of the public across the line politically would agree with is try to ensure more legal pathways for immigration, as opposed to right now we have a kind of stasis in the political system, which means because you do have this worldwide migration effect, and you see this in Europe, you see the political problems that it's creating for European governments as well. So this is not something that's exclusive here, but we need to create more legal pathways. The other thing politically that I would note is that among Hispanics, for instance, which you would think with, since much of this migration is Hispanic, that you would think that Trump would be losing support. He actually gained support among Hispanics in the 2020 election from 16, and all the polling suggests that he's going to do maybe even double the support he had among Hispanics in 24 than he did in 20. You look at counties in South Texas, which have changed politically, and to Republicans' advantage. So it's the political dynamic is, I think, the important thing to note here. What Biden is doing is entirely political, and I just don't think it's going to have much in the way of benefit for him ultimately.
I want to go to Bob here in a second. We do have to take a break, so I'll pause, and when we come back, we'll check in with Bob, and then we'll go to letters. We have many, so we'll get to those as well. You're listening to the panel on WAMC, John Faso, Bob Griffin, and Sarah Rogerson. We'll continue our conversation after this news break from the BBC. I stood him up, oh, just to watch him fly. Fantastic Cat providing our music this morning and performing at the Green River Festival on the 21st of June. Their new album is Now That's What I Call Fantastic. You can check out the playlist by going to wamc.org/roundtable, wamc.org/roundtable. Our panel continues. John Faso, Sarah Rogerson, and Bob Griffin. Anything you'd like to say before we go to letters?
Yeah, just a couple of quick points. One, I thought John's point was really interesting about the HB1 and 2 visas. And there's another area that I want to put on the table for our listeners to think about, too, is that how important immigration has been to the expansion of our tech industry. To think about the ability to bring sort of an entrepreneurial spirit. And I would argue that at its heart, it really helped drive a lot of what happened in Silicon Valley and a lot of the innovation triangles. I will also apologize if you're hearing sirens. The Chicago Fire Department loves their sirens.
I thought your ride was showing up.
Yeah. They're coming to take me away. Sarah, you raised an interesting point that I'd like to ask you to go back to explain to folks. We've created a barrier. So people come to this country because they want a better life and they want to work. A lot of them want to work. So this idea of people are trying to immigrate here to take our money and take our jobs. You're talking about people who really want to work, but they are legally prohibited from working, which makes no sense. Think about a position where, okay, you can come into a country, but then you're told that there's no way for you to actually raise the money that you need in order to survive with your family. That's part of the system that was created. Isn't that correct, Sarah? Is that a fair...
Yeah, you have to, in order to apply for what's called employment and an employment authorization document, or EAD, you have to have a statutory basis, which is usually predicated on achieving some form of status. So you have to go through the whole process of applying and then having immigration approve your application before or acknowledge that it's pending and that you're eligible to apply for employment authorization in order to even start the process to get the document to be able to work. So long story short, most people can't work for 6 months to a year once they get here. There's one way to do it, and that's to come in on parole. The folks we brought over from Afghanistan, many of them came in with parole and they were provided employment authorization. But again, that's predicated on having a particular form of status.
Yeah, and I think the reason for that 6 month minimum is that the logic behind that was to say you don't want someone to come and then create an incentive because you're going to immediately be able to work. It would be better if we had a system whereby someone who wanted to come to the United States presented their credentials, made the application in their home country before they even came. But the problem we have now is that we've just had, it's estimated since 2021, about 8 to 9 million people that have come across the border, not necessarily through legal ports of entry, but have come through other areas, and that's what has created this massive influx. The system has never been designed to handle this amount of people coming over. And of course, the vast majority of people who claim asylum are actually not eligible for asylum. But the process is someone comes over through not a legal port of entry. They then turn themselves into border control. They plead asylum. Then they're giving a hearing 4 or 5 years from now. And in the meantime, they're released into the United States. And that's, you see in New York City. I mean, you can't go to New York City. If you've gone past the Roosevelt Hotel or some of these other places, you see this human catastrophe that's going on. And so many people in the city have said to me that, wow, they've really opened their eyes to the immigration problem because they're seeing it in their daily lives. And then, of course, you have the rare but very unfortunate incidents 2 days ago where a 19-year-old Venezuelan migrant on a scooter shot two New York City police officers. And, of course, that gets a lot of publicity, as it should, but it creates a lot of anxiety and animosity in the minds of local residents when they see and read these kind of stories.
And I do just want to make a correction. It's not that the vast majority of asylum seekers are not eligible. It's that the grant rates are low and vary depending on the political orientation of the immigration judge. That's been well established. So,
but I think it's 80 to 90% of them who apply for asylum and actually get through the process are denied.
Well, that weeds out the length of the process weeds out a lot of meritable claims. I would also point out that there's been a concerted effort, really spearheaded by Stephen Miller and the Trump presidency, to further narrow the ability to achieve this. I've argued asylum cases for 20 years, so I've seen meritable, worthy cases denied regularly. By function of a broken law.
And in my congressional office back in 17 and 18, we handled many immigration issues, and there, you know, it's not a black and white issue. Oftentimes, there are a lot of shades of gray when you're dealing with individual circumstances. But again, when you have 8 or 9 million people coming over in a short period of time, it makes it impossible for the system to process.
Go ahead, Bob. I want to get to letters, but go ahead.
Real quick, but I mean, you're right about a couple of issues, though. The system isn't designed to process it, and this gets even more frustrating when you see the holdup in Congress of passing budgets on time the way they're supposed to. But the other element of this, though, is this is also a sign of how our policies and our laws aren't keeping up with what the changes are in our current society. And the issues of a declining birth rate, you know, we talk about the drop in the number of children, which means that there's going to be a gap in the number of bodies available in order to fill the jobs that we need to be filled. And immigration offers an alternative to this. We have demonized immigration to the point, though, where we're not talking about how critical it is to our future workforce. And there must be a way to start to think about linking, immigration numbers with employment rates there. But the conversation has become, John, so black, in my mind, so black and white in Congress that we aren't even able to talk about some of those really important nuances that you were just referencing. As we just saw from the last Congress, right? I mean, the bill that was scuttled in Congress by Trump's intransigence, I think is a prime example of how politicized this critical issue has become.
Yeah, well, you're absolutely right in terms of demographics. You could look at it in terms of the Social Security system. You can look at it in terms of all the jobs that are going begging now in our economy. So there's a critical need to address this, and also the reference to Silicon Valley. You look at some of the most successful companies in the United States, particularly in the tech area, they are led by immigrants to this country, whether it's Google or you look at many of the big tech firms now. I mean, so bringing in, allowing people to come in who have specific qualifications, too, is something that I've long advocated for.
Let's go to letters, and then we'll have to take a quick break, and we'll come back and we'll get to more. Chad says, what do we say when someone says, quote, people come here to work and they send the money to their families outside the U.S., and this is a problem. I hear that all the time.
Yeah, they also pay taxes and feed into the social safety net of our country. We don't question whether when a family makes money and takes their family to Disneyland, it's not a crime. You know, you're right. Free to spend your money however you want. But the idea is that they're also living here. They're also paying rent. They're also eating here. There's lots of things that they're doing. And yes, they're also supporting their family, which last time I checked was a good thing to do.
Well, it's also consistent with what happened historically. You look at the waves of Italian and Polish and Irish, German immigrants at the turn of the 19th century. This was very typical. You send your money back so that your brother and sister from the home country can come to the United States. It's not unusual.
Or so they can stay where they are.
Yeah.
I mean, I'm a grandson of immigrants from both Irish and Italian. I can tell you that the Italian side, they subsidized the families back in Calabria, Italy, who stayed there. Mm. So it actually helps reduce the flow of people wanting to come here.
We get this letter from John who says, of course, it's political just as much for Republicans as it is for Democrats. What do you think motivated the Republicans to reject their own legislation? Then Mike checks in and says, once again, Joe Biden has shifted the bipartisan consensus of American politics to the right on a critical issue. Our national security apparatus has seen the hockey stick graphs and is choosing to embrace fear, to embrace isolation, to embrace the militarization of our border, and to continue to scapegoat immigrants and asylum seekers as some kind of scourge. Excellent work, Mr. President. Sure is great that he is the standard bearer and leader of the Democratic Party at the moment. That from Mike. We go to this letter from Jim. Immigration is a net benefit to the USA and conversely a drain on the countries they leave. Also, I believe that the six-month wait to work for asylum seekers was part of an earlier reform to discourage economic migrants. We need a better legal immigration system, but it may never be enough to meet demand. I am a privileged immigrant. That from Jim. We'll take a quick break. We'll come back. We'll do more letters, hopefully get to another topic or two. We'll return right after this. Back at it on this Wednesday morning, June 5th. Thank you for being with us. Panel at WAMC.org. If you'd like to get in and share your thoughts on the issues that we're discussing this morning. So far, it's been about immigration. Terry writes, immigration policy in the U.S. cannot remain the same. The New York Times did a big write-up a few months ago about a business helping migrants cross the Darien Gap. This has been a natural barrier. Since the physical migration is being made easier, this requires that the U.S. change its policy. It's all about incentives. Then we go to Charles. We naturalize 800,000 new citizens a year, even under Trump and Obama before him. If that is not enough, what is the number? Is that the number, 800,000? Is that roughly the number?
I have no idea. Okay. I'd have to look it up. But the number is whatever the migration patterns demand, and those patterns are a function of largely man-made, quite literally, interventions in society. So it's rather than focusing on those numbers, I think it's more helpful to note the contributions, the economic boost that immigrants provide, particularly when they're naturalized.
Doug writes in response to, go ahead, Bob.
Really quickly to jump in on that, I mean, that number is a fictitious number. Okay, there isn't, in my mind, rationale that you can add to it. It's what is politically palatable rather than what the country needs.
Yeah.
So, you know, we've talked a little bit about tech. You know, think about nursing. Think about what we, you know, the type of support we need in our healthcare as we age. Think about what we need in the military, given the fact that we're not having as many children as we are. So all of these issues, you know, you say 800,000, it sounds like a huge number, not when you start talking about a country of our size.
Yeah.
So I would argue that number is way short, and it is only built around the idea of what is politically palatable rather than needed.
Doug writes to us and says, in response to John Faso's opinion on President Biden's border announcement, he failed to mention that Congress, specifically Republicans, failed to pass the bipartisan Senate bill to help resolve the border issues. And they did it only because Trump needed to keep it as an attack issue in the campaign. His plan will not resolve the border issue, but at least he's doing what is in his power to make things better and slow down the illegal entry. President Biden, in his announcement, made it clear that only Congress can totally fix the problem. John.
Well, I've said all along that we do need to have legal changes, but rather than trying to get all or nothing, I would rather get something. And I think, you know, being incremental in terms of the legal changes, I mentioned the H2A and H2B visas, for instance. Those are the kind of things that I think would be highly useful and beneficial to the economy and to the country. But if we take an all or nothing approach, which many on the left and right seem to want, I don't think you accomplish very much. And evidence is that we didn't accomplish anything in the last decade on immigration from a legal standpoint. So I would rather us focus on trying to, instead of using this term comprehensive immigration reform, focus on things that are easily digestible, politically sustainable, and will able to get support among the public.
Sometimes there are stories that come across that I'm like, oh, was that a thing? I missed that it was a thing. So apparently the Food and Drug Administration has been scratching its head for a while over whether taking ecstasy was a way of helping and effective for treating post-traumatic stress disorder. Now the FDA and an advisory committee overwhelmingly voted Tuesday that evidence is lacking that MDMA, ecstasy, therapy is effective for treating post-traumatic stress disorder and that the benefits don't outweigh the risks to patients, dealing a potential blow to what could be the first psychedelic treatment the agency approves. The advisory committee is made up of an independent mental health and medical is made up of independent mental health and medical experts, and its vote is not binding. Still, its recommendation could hold great weight as the FDA decides for the first time whether the mind-altering compound, better known by its street name, ecstasy, and long categorized among the riskiest of controlled substances, can be legally used as medical treatment in the United States. During the all-day meeting, committee members praised the promise of the drug but struggled with gaps in the research data, potential for abuse, and how the psychotherapy, which is not regulated by the FDA, would be incorporated into the drug's approval. Bob, what do you make of this?
This is a fascinating story to me, Joe, because I had been aware of research that had been going on. You know, you start to think about what happened with folks in military and our health providers, our responder community dealing with PTSD, and it's a huge problem. When you look at the suicide rates of people who have served our communities in some of these positions, this is a real and growing problem. I found it fascinating for a couple of reasons. One is that it's impossible for me not to start to think back to the LSD trials back in the 60s and sort of the genesis of where our laws have come regarding these types of drugs. They sort of became associated with the hippie movement, which became sort of the counterculture movement. And I think we actually lost a lot of opportunity to study the validity of these substances to deal with some pretty serious psychological issues. I also was fascinated, was digging into the whole issue of the psychotherapy issue. I think was one of the stumbling blocks. I mean, it was this whole research was described as really messy, which I think is fair. I mean, we're talking about some really cutting edge research into how our brains operate, I just hope that what the FDA doesn't do, which they have done in the past, is just slam the door on it, not recognizing how important this could be. The other issue I have, and I'm really concerned about, is there are people suffering right now who have shown huge benefits from this approach, and I don't want them hurt by this decision.
And it's also related to the emerging science around psychedelic mushrooms,
right?
Which anybody who has a Netflix account has probably seen promos for a number of documentaries on the healing power of mushrooms and sort of what's emerging from the scientific community around that. So this ecstasy is chemically based in a way that psychedelic mushrooms are more rooted in a what's seen as like a natural remedy. So, you know, I don't know how much they'll be related when it comes through the FDA process, but Bob's 100% right. My mind went right to the 60s and LSD.
Timothy Leary.
Scare.
Yeah.
Yeah.
John?
I really don't have anything to add. I mean, I'm not expert at this. I don't even pretend to have the faintest knowledge about it. Reading the story was the first time I paid any attention. But what struck me was that it was a large majority of the advisory committee that declined to go forward. So I think that in the past, that's been pretty influential in terms of ultimate decision of the FDA. So where this goes, I really don't know, but obviously the company trying to promote this may have to go back to the drawing board.
And Bob, do you have a sense as to it? I agree in the fascinating aspect of the story of sort of now what, and what it means even for our knowledge of the use of ecstasy as a street drug, of how we categorize it.
Yeah, I don't see many changes in the legal classification. What I do think the company is going to have to do is they're going to have to go back and work to clean up some of their tests. So trying to reduce the number of variables. And you know, Joe, I said during COVID, you know, science is messy, and this is just part of the scientific process of discovery. So actually, I think this whole process is healthy. One of the things that I need to do more research into is I want to see who is on the panel. One of the concerns that I have sometimes about these panels is that they become very clubby in the sense that it's the same folks from the same organizations representing the same positions, which sometimes can actually have an inverse and negative impact on new and novel approaches to dealing with problems. So I need to go back and see who is on the panel to sort of better understand where they were coming from. But this is showing promise that I think it would be bad to ignore.
Well, with that, we are out of time for this Wednesday morning. My thanks to everybody for taking part, all the letters that we got. Of course, thanks to our wonderful panelists, John Faso, Bob Griffin, Sarah Rogerson.
Well, this panel has been ecstasy just in and of itself.
I thought you didn't know anything about it.
Yeah. we thank you all for being with us. Thanks to everybody who helped out on the lockbox. That was amazing. You can still help, WAMC.org, WAMC.org. And we'll be back with more Roundtable after this short break.